This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, this is Sean Curran with the Today in Parliament podcast. On Wednesday, the 11th of October, the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said the government was in chaos.
If the Prime Minister can't lead, she should leave.
But the Prime Minister defends her record.
The deficit down by over two-thirds. Three million more people in jobs.
Also tonight, Theresa May and her Chancellor appear to contradict each other over spending money to prepare for the prospect of the UK leaving the European Union without a Brexit deal. Philip Hammond says it's too early to set aside the funds.
I don't believe that we should be in the business of spending, of making potentially nugatory expenditure until the very last moment.
But a short time later, the Prime Minister tells MPs that the government will do whatever is necessary to make sure the UK is ready for Brexit. And she says the money is already being committed. The Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, used the first session of Prime Minister's questions since the conference break to highlight concerns about the biggest ever change to the welfare system.
The rollout of universal credit is already causing debt, poverty and homelessness. Does the Prime Minister accept it would be irresponsible to press on regardless?
Universal credit replaces other benefits. Ministers say the single payment, made once a month, like a salary, will be simpler and fairer. But its introduction has been controversial. There have been complaints that people have been left without any money for weeks on end and calls for a pause in the rollout of the system. And there's been talk of a rebellion by Conservative MPs. On Sunday, the Tory former Prime Minister Sir John Major called universal credit operationally messy, socially unfair and unforgiving. Theresa May told Jeremy Corbyn that under Labour, the welfare system had been too complicated, with too many people finding they were better off on benefits rather than in work.
That is not the system that we want. What we want is universal credit, which is simpler, more straightforward and makes sure that work always pays.
Jeremy Corbyn said the Prime Minister needed to wake up to reality, and he quoted Citizens Advice, which had called universal credit a disaster waiting to happen.
Not only are people being driven into poverty, but absurdly, Mr Speaker, the universal credit helpline costs claimants 55 pence per minute for the privilege of trying to get someone to help them claim what they believe they're entitled to. Will the Prime Minister today show some humanity, intervene and make at least the helpline free?
I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, I've made very clear that we continue to look at how we're dealing with this and ensuring that we get this system out in a way that is actually working for people and the performance is increasing, and it is working because more people are getting into work on universal credit than were on job seekers' allowance.
The Labour leader broadened his attack in his final question when he said universal credit was just one in a string of failures.
Everywhere you look, it's a government in chaos. On the most important issues facing this country, it's a shambles. Brexit negotiations made no progress. Bombardier and other workers facing redundancy. Most working people worse off. Young people pushed into record levels of debt. 1 million elderly people not getting essential care. Our NHS at breaking point. Mr Speaker, this government is more interested in fighting amongst themselves than in solving these problems.
At this, Conservative MPs began to shout and point at the Labour benches. Labour retaliated in kind.
Mr Speaker, isn't it the case, Mr Speaker, that if the Prime Minister can't lead, she should leave?
Yeah. Theresa May defended the government's record.
The deficit down by over two-thirds. Yeah. 3 million more people in jobs. Yeah. 1.8 million more children in good or outstanding schools. More people visiting A&E. More people getting operations than ever before. Record levels of funding into the NHS. Record levels of funding. record levels of funding in the NHS, record levels of funding into our schools. But what did we see about the Labour Party? What did we see about the Labour Party from their conference? Well, what we saw...
Now it was the Prime Minister's turn to pause as the noise levels rose and the Speaker, John Bercow, complained that MPs had become overexcited. The Labour heckles continued when Theresa May resumed her comments about the party's conference and policies.
The Equalities and Human Rights Commission said Labour need to establish that it is not a racist party. And the Labour leader of Brighton Council threatened to ban Labour conferences because of freely expressed anti-Semitism. And that was all before the Shadow Chancellor admitted a Labour government would bring a run on the pound and ordinary working people would pay the price.
As the Prime Minister sat down, Conservative MPs waved their order papers and shouted for more. But the next question was from a Tory who was worried about universal credit. Heidi Allen said she wanted the new system to work.
But there are many of us on this side of the House that feel that more people taking those advances must surely mean that the inbuilt six-week wait just doesn't work. Yeah. My question is to the Prime Minister, would she please consider meeting with me so I can explain to her why if we reduce that six-week wait, we will do a better job of supporting those just about managing families who are struggling to make ends meet and have no savings to cover them over that period.
Theresa May agreed to meet Heidi Allen.
And in terms of the advance payments, they can be with people within 5 days or in an emergency on the very same day.
The Prime Minister. Now, the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, spent the morning reassuring MPs that the Treasury was preparing for a range of Brexit scenarios, including no deal and what he called a bad-tempered breakdown in negotiations. He said £250 million had already been allocated to government departments, but he wasn't going to start spending taxpayers' cash until the very last moment. Christina Cooper reports.
It was the Chancellor's turn to pick up the baton on Brexit. First, an article in The Times about planning for a no-deal scenario, which caused a bit of a stir. Then an appearance before the Treasury Committee, where the committee chair, the Conservative Nicky Morgan, was after more details.
I'd like to know how the Treasury is preparing, how it considers it is prepared, and at what point it's going to disclose to the public and to this sovereign parliament how it is preparing for something like a no-deal scenario.
Well, first of all, I'm glad you've asked me this question because I wrote the piece for The Times this morning to emphasise that we are prepared to spend when we need to spend against the contingency of a no-deal outcome. So rather surprised to see it written up as the opposite.
Philip Hammond told her the Treasury had already allocated £250 million from reserves to government departments. But he wasn't proposing to spend taxpayers' hard-earned money earlier than necessary.
Every pound we spend on contingent preparations for a hard customs border is a pound that we can't spend on the NHS or social care or education or deficit reduction. And I don't believe that we should be in the business of spending, of making potentially nugatory expenditure until the very last moment when we need to do so.
With negotiations between the UK and the EU making slow progress, organisations planning for Brexit haven't got much to go on. The Chancellor said preparations were underway for a range of outcomes, including no deal and even a bad-tempered breakdown of negotiations. And he pondered on the most extreme scenario.
It is theoretically conceivable that in a no-deal scenario there will be no air traffic moving between the UK and the European Union on the 29th of March 2019. But I don't think anybody seriously believes that is where we will get to.
He quickly reassured everyone that even without a deal, mutual self-interest would create a strong compulsion to reach an agreement on air traffic services. The Prime Minister tried to nudge Brexit talks along with her speech in Florence last month, proposing a transition period of 2 years in which things would essentially remain the same. The Chancellor hoped the EU would start talking to the UK soon.
Look at our proposals. As I said this morning, by all means challenge them, kick the tyres. But this is a shared problem. And if we don't talk about it, we're not going to get to a solution on a timescale that allows that future partnership that I do believe the vast majority of our European partners want to achieve.
Philip Hammond voted to remain in the EU and he's been criticised for not being cheerful enough about Brexit. With the Cabinet a mixed bag of Brexiteers and Remainers, a Labour MP, Wes Streeting, doubted whether there was a consistent government position.
I think it's fair to ask Chancellor the extent to which you're speaking for the government on some of these key issues, because particularly on financial services, the message I think we receive is that they have a great deal of confidence in the Treasury and no doubt the interactions they're having on a daily basis, that the Treasury understand these issues and the Treasury's position is sensible. But they read the newspapers and find a whole series of contradictory statements, not made by members of the governing party, but members of the Cabinet.
The Prime Minister and Chancellor, he said, were saying different things to senior members of the government.
And in the context of these contradictory statements, do you think it is helpful or harmful to the UK's national interest to have contradictory and competing statements made by members of the Cabinet around issues that are quite fundamental to securing a good transition and a good long-term deal?
I'm not sure I recognise the picture that you're painting. Clearly, there has been a
And people say you're gloomy. I don't understand why.
clearly, there has been a debate and a discussion, but we've come to a clear position. It was set out in the Florence speech.
A Conservative, Charlie Elphick, wondered when Mr Hammond would start spending money on contingency plans.
In the Times today, you write that you will release funding only when it's responsible to do so. You said earlier it's not a demonstration point. Can you explain further what you mean by that and what circumstances you envisage it would be responsible to spend funds preparing for a no deal?
So it's the point I was making is that some are urging me to spend money simply to send a message to the EU that we mean business. I think the EU knows that we mean business.
And Mr Elphick was curious to know what he made of the whole Brexit project.
How do you think Britain will be better off after Brexit?
Once we are no longer inside the European Union, we will be free, obviously, from the constraints of compliance with European Union law. We will be free to make our own decisions.
The Chancellor went on to qualify that remark, saying that no country in the modern world, except North Korea, was entirely immune from what was going on in other countries. It was too simple to say the UK would be completely free because its decisions would have consequences.
Christina Cooper. Well, Mr Hammond appeared in front of the Treasury Committee before this week's session of Prime Minister's Questions. The Chancellor was in his place next to Theresa May on the government front bench when the Conservative former leader Ian Duncan-Smith asked the Prime Minister about those preparations in case the UK left the European Union without a deal.
Could she confirm then that all monies necessary will be allocated as and when required to this project?
Yeah. Theresa May said the government was preparing for every eventuality, including a no-deal scenario. And she appeared to contradict Mr Hammond's earlier remarks to the Treasury Committee when she said she could give MPs an update.
The Treasury has committed over £250 million of new money to departments like DEFRA, Home Office, HMRC and DfT in this financial year for Brexit preparations. And in some cases, departments will need to spend money before the relevant legislation has gone through the House. And I can tell the House that the Treasury will write to departments and to the Public Accounts Committee explaining this process shortly. So where money needs to be spent, it will be spent.
On Tuesday night, the Prime Minister took part in a radio phone-in on LBC. In spite of being asked several times, Mrs May refused to say how she would vote if there was another referendum on the UK's membership of the European Union. The leader of the SNP at Westminster, Ian Blackford, suggested that the reason the Prime Minister couldn't answer the question was because she was hamstrung by the lack of a parliamentary majority.
If there was another EU referendum now, I know I would vote to remain. Why hasn't the Prime Minister been straightforward about how she would vote?
There is no second referendum. The United Kingdom voted, and we will be leaving the European Union in March 2019.
A Liberal Democrat, former Scottish Secretary Alistair Carmichael, raised another aspect of Brexit.
Is it the Prime Minister's intention that the United Kingdom should remain part of the Common Fisheries Policy during any transitional period after we have left the European Union?
When we leave the European Union, we will be leaving the Common Fisheries Policy. As part of the agreement that we need to enter into for the implementation period, obviously this and other issues will be part of that agreement. But when we leave the European Union, we will leave the Common Fisheries Policy.
Theresa May. You're listening to Today in Parliament with me, Sean Curran. Still to come, why have some of their lordships fallen out of love with Love Island? But first, there have been calls for an independent inquiry led by a judge to look into the way Wiltshire Police investigated allegations of child sexual abuse against the former Conservative Prime Minister, Sir Edward Heath. Simon Jones reports.
Sir Edward Heath, who led a Conservative government from 1970 to 74, died in 2005, aged 89. Wiltshire Police launched Operation Conifer to investigate allegations that the former Prime Minister had sexually assaulted children in 2015. Last week, the force said Sir Edward would have been interviewed under caution over seven claims, including the alleged rape of an 11-year-old, but the police said no inference of guilt should be drawn. The report has faced criticism. A former head of the civil service, Lord Armstrong, who was Sir Edward's private secretary when he was Prime Minister, used an urgent question in the Lords to call for an independent judicial review. He said Sir Edward Heath's reputation had been left under a cloud of suspicion since 2015.
When an officer of the Wiltshire Police made an ill-judged public appeal outside Sir Edward's house in Salisbury for victims of child abuse by Sir Edward Heath and others to come forward and make themselves known to the police. The report of the investigation, published last Thursday, more than 2 years later, does nothing either to justify or to dispel that suspicion.
The Home Office Minister, Lady Williams of Trafford, said it was for chief officers to decide how best to carry out their duties and for local police and crime commissioners to hold them to account.
The vital principle at the heart of British policing is that police can carry out their duties independently and make decisions free from political influence. As such, the commissioning of any independent review, judge-led or otherwise, would be a matter for the police.
Complaints about the conduct of the investigation could, she said, be referred to the Independent Police Complaints Commission. A former Chancellor, the Conservative Lord Lawson, supported the call for an inquiry and went further.
Would it not be appropriate, also and on top of what he has suggested, for the Controller and Auditor General look into what has been a grotesque misuse of large sums of public money? Yeah, yeah.
Labour's Lord Rosser wanted a clarification.
Which elected person, if any, has had the statutory power, if they so chose to use it, to challenge how the Operation Conifer investigation was being conducted, or even to stop the investigation?
Lady Williams said it would have been a matter for the local police and crime commissioner. Another former cabinet minister, the Conservative Lord McGregor, was the head of Sir Edward's private office when he was leader of the opposition in the 1960s.
And I have to say that I think the most damning indictment of Operation Conifer was from Ken MacDonald, the former Director of Public Prosecutions, who was in the best position to know when he called it a sham. And there is another problem. If distinguished contributors to our public life, like Edward Heath, are treated in this way, is that not a major disincentive to others to wish to enter public life? I do urge the government to think again.
A former Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Lord Blair, offered a way forward.
The Chief Inspector of Constabulary is the person who could actually intervene in this matter, and we could start there. Whether it's a judicial inquiry that follows, but the Chief Inspector of Constabulary is the person to whom the government should look for an inquiry to begin as to whether this has been done properly.
Lady Williams repeated that it was for the local police and crime commissioner to hold a force and its chief constable to account, and any investigation or inquiry was a matter for them.
Simon Jones. MPs have been marking Baby Loss Awareness Week, and today a Conservative, Antoinette Sambatch, whose five-day-old son died from sudden infant death syndrome, proposed changing the law to regulate the sale of devices designed to listen to babies' heartbeats at home. She said fetal Dopplers were sold to pregnant mothers.
Whilst I've heard some consumers speak in favour of Dopplers, and I'm not suggesting that they have no use, there is evidence that they can falsely reassure people about the health of their baby. We must place that responsibility in the hands of medical professionals and encourage mothers to respond to changes in movements of their baby rather than devices that can be bought over the counter for £30.
MPs gave Antoinette Sambatch's bill initial approval under the 10-minute rule, but it's unlikely to make any further progress unless it gets government support. Now, in what was seen as an attempt to win over young voters, Theresa May used last week's Conservative conference to announce plans to freeze university tuition fees in England and to raise the threshold at which graduates pay back student loans. Labour used an urgent question to ask about the government's long-term plans. Rob Powell reports.
At the Conservative conference, the Prime Minister said one message she had taken from the general election was that her party needed to listen to younger voters. It was in that spirit that Theresa May announced the scrapping of a planned £250 rise in university tuition fees in England. They had been due to go up to £9,500 per year. Also, an offer to graduates in England. They will now only start repaying their student loans once their salaries reach £25,000, rather than the current threshold of £21,000. Labour's Shadow Education Secretary, Angela Rayner, had some questions about the policies.
Can the Secretary of State or the Minister tell us how much these policy changes will cost? How much more will taxpayers contribute and how much interest receivable is lost? Will the reduced income be replaced by additional funding?
On funding, the government has promised to explain how it will pay for these changes in next month's budget, and the university's Minister Joe Johnson remained tight-lipped on the issue of money.
We are listening and, where appropriate, we are taking action to ensure that our student finance system is getting the balance right, getting the balance of interest right between those of students and those of the general taxpayer. That's the core principle of our student finance system.
Another part of the government's changes involved a pledge to look again at the whole system of student finance. Angela Rayner wanted more details of any planned review and took a jab at the Conservative minister, who is the brother of Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson.
Who will sit on it? When will it start and finish? Who decided this policy and how and when? And is it true the Universities Minister was unaware until the Prime Minister announced it? Surely he can't be the least favoured minister in the Johnson household.
Another Labour MP, Liz McInnes, wanted to know about student loan interest rates, which can be as high as 6.1% for some graduates.
Can I also urge the Minister to look at the issue of the interest rate repayment, the RPI index, which is used for student loans? It's an outdated measure. It's not the government's measure of choice. It makes our students' debts even more extortionate, and we should be looking at CPI, not RPI.
Mr Johnson said interest rates and every aspect of higher education funding was kept under careful review. But he said it was appropriate to use the higher RPI measure of inflation to set loan interest rates.
RPI has been the historic measure of inflation used for the student finance system. In some ways, it's more appropriate than CPI in the sense that it takes account of, amongst other things, mortgage interest payments and council tax. These are typical expenses for graduates which are not included in the calculation of CPI.
Many in the House want to see an end to tuition fees altogether. Labour is promising to scrap them if it comes to power. And north of the border, Scottish students who study at home already pay no fees. For the SNP, Carol Monaghan said the UK government should follow Scotland's lead.
We've got average debt and graduation in England now at more than £50,000. So this announcement needs to be part of a wider reform of student support and funding, which must include bursaries, grants and the abolition of tuition fees.
Responding, the minister called tuition fees an unsung policy success that allowed universities to take in more students, including those from disadvantaged backgrounds. The father of the house, the Conservative former Chancellor, Kenneth Clark, agreed and recounted his own student days.
With hindsight, I was lucky enough to have low-paid people, people in low-paid jobs, paying taxes in order to maintain me in my living costs when I was studying and being trained to be a reasonably successful barrister when I emerged from the university.
An outdated age for some, the good old days for others, as arguments over university funding rumble on.
Rob Powell. Now, yesterday, some of the leading firms in the so-called gig economy defended their use of self-employed drivers, riders and couriers. Today, MPs heard from Matthew Taylor, the head of a government review into the employment rights of such workers. He explained why his review had recommended that in certain circumstances, firms would not have to pay the national minimum wage.
If Uber drivers, Deliveroo couriers, other on-demand workers are classified as workers and get the minimum wage, we will probably have to end on-demand work. And that the people who work on those platforms will be disappointed if we end on-demand work because they value being able to do it. Now, that's a choice that we have to make. We try to find a way around it if you think the risk is too great. I understand that. But the consequence would be the end of on-demand work.
Matthew Taylor. Now, are the rules on showing smoking on television strict enough? A Liberal Democrat, Lord Storey, who's a former head teacher, wanted to ask the Culture Minister, Lord Ashton, about a particular reality television show.
I don't know if he's a regular watcher of Love Island, but if you were to look at the ITV website, it describes Love Island as an emotional feast of lust and passion in the sun.
Lord Storey said the programme was very popular with 16 to 34-year-olds.
On this programme, those contestants are regularly smoking. What message does that say to young people? That I can live a glamorous life if I smoke as well. And I'm surprised that Ofcom Broadcasting Code says that smoking must not be glamorised in programmes like to be seen widely or heard by under 18-year-olds unless there is editorial justification.
Shouldn't the regulator, Ofcom, take action, he asked. Lord Ashton wanted to clear up something right at the start.
My Lords, I'm not a regular watcher of Love Island, but I can't help noticing the House is unusually full today.
He said Ofcom regulated the broadcasting code.
Any complaints about any programme will be investigated by Ofcom, and of course it's up to anyone who's got concerns about smoking in this programme to complain to Ofcom. Incidentally, just to put it in perspective, Ofcom had just under 15,000 complaints last year and 75 related to smoking on Love Island.
And those comments from the Culture Minister, Lord Ashton, bring us to the closing headlines from Westminster. The Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, called for the rollout of universal credit to be put on hold. He said the changes to the welfare system had driven up debt, poverty and homelessness. The Chancellor and the Prime Minister appeared to contradict each other over whether or not the government is willing to spend money now in case the UK ends up leaving the European Union without a deal. I'm Sean Curran. The editor was Rachel Byrne, and that was the Today in Parliament podcast. Thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.